good morning, everyone, and welcome to another action-packed episode of The Other Side of Midnight. You know, the more I do this show and the more the world turns, the more things become kind of connected and in line and in alignment, because what's the premise of this show? That things are not exactly as they appear, A, that there is no real dividing line between paranormal and normal. That's all our perception. And yesterday's science is today's fact, and, you know, yesterday's superstition is tomorrow's reality. So what this show is trying to do is to show the interconnectedness of stuff. So we're going to kind of have a wide-ranging discussion tonight with an old friend of mine, just basically about stuff. And he's in New York, and I'm in the land of enchantment, and it's 75 degrees, actually maybe 73 now, Patrick, if you're paying attention. So if you all go to theothersideofmidnight.com and go over to Radio with Pictures, just kind of look at the items that I have listed tonight as part of the world, the consciousness moment we're going to talk about in the next 2 hours. We've, of course, got Brexit. There's a headline up there from Brexit. There are additional amplifications of the waves of the shock of Brexit. Item number two, the Supreme Court dealt the Texas abortion restrictions an incredible blow today and ruled on a whole number of other things, marijuana and other, you know, financing. And so you might want to go and check out links two and three. This really is remarkable, coming on the eve, you know, cosmically speaking, of this election. Did you see, this is going to be kind of sounding like a non sequitur, but it's not. Did you see Hillary and Elizabeth today? Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Warren campaigning together in blue. Actually, Hillary was wearing purple, but on most TV sets it looked blue. So talk about fascinating. I mean, you've got the whole ISIS mythology right there. Women taking their power, confronting Donald Trump, given his background and his perspectives and his track record on women. I mean, we are looking at times that are so epical, that are moving in such extraordinary directions. I mean, now take a look at item number four. In the midst of Brexit, in the midst of the banks, in the midst of the pound sterling falling like a streamlined anvil, Iceland, little tiny Iceland, beat England in soccer today, blew them away. And the announcer, of course, the Icelandic announcer is endearing himself to the world because he just can't stand it. And finally, in Washington, D.C., before we get to my guest in a couple of minutes, they hung the USS Enterprise at the Smithsonian, moved it from the basement where it had been relegated for the last several years. They've now moved it up to the main floor, the main deck. You know, if you're into omens and symbolism and looking at the world and where we're headed, and haven't even talked about the most amazing things we found on Mars, which I might do tomorrow night. If Stephen's on to talk a bit about Hillary and where she is in the whole UFO as she's running, I might spring a surprise on you tomorrow night as opposed to in a week or so. We have found something so remarkable, so astonishing, so amazingly clear as to what it is and what it represents on Mars, an artifact, a major ancient artifact that almost anybody's going to look at and say, oh my God. So we may talk about that tomorrow night. But the implications are that they're moving the Enterprise up to the main hall to get ready for the D word. I mean, all those amazing things that Gene envisioned and all the people around him are coming true. And we're going to talk about that at some length, particularly in the realm of consciousness, because the world is spinning into some place that we have never been before, and so we must boldly go. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we will be right back. And we are back on this very nicely warm Land of Enchantment evening. Early morning, my friend Daniel Pinchbeck, who is currently in another warm place this evening in New York City, is an American author with a passion for understanding consciousness and how we can expand it to find our own truths. He's the author of Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey into the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism, and 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. He is a co-founder of Evolver, a lifestyle community platform that publishes Reality Sandwich, an online magazine centered on spirituality, philosophy, and activism. Philosophically influenced by the work of anthroposophist Rudolf Steiner, through direct experience and research, Pinchbeck developed the hypothesis that shamanic and mystical views of reality have validity, and that the modern world has forfeited an understanding of intuitive aspects of being in pursuit of its intense rational materialism. Well, Daniel, we have a lot to talk about this morning because I've got some data. Good morning and welcome to The Other Side of Midnight.
Hi, Richard. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's been kind of a long journey, and I'm using that in a kind of a Campbellian view. There is so much going on this planet right now. It's almost impossible to know where to begin to look at things which are telling us that reality is not what we have constructed. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to, so I'm curious how you break that down.
Well, some of the things you've been doing is in terms of shamanic experiences and how Western cultures are not really doing that, and Eastern and other, you know, world cultures do, and they've had a long lineal history, and that's kind of leading to our psychological crisis. I mean, we're going through in the developed world a set of psychological crises, which over here are exemplifying themselves as an incredible penchant to vote for a guy named Donald Trump. And in Britain, you know, we're finding now they want to leave the European Union, although they have zero plan for what to do after they leave, turns out this morning, to, you know, the problems of Greece, the problems of Eastern Europe, the problems of, you know, Kiev, of Russia, of Ukraine, not to say anything about China, and of course Japan and Korea and all that. In other words, when you look around the globe, developed societies are exemplifying a ferment, a bursting at the chains for something different than the path we're on, that we've been on for the last 40, 50, 60, maybe 100 years. That's what I'm wanting to get at tonight is, yeah, where does that impulse to simply throw it all over and do something different, where's that coming from?
Okay, Richard, I mean, that's a great question, and I now sort of understand more where you're at. I mean, yes, I mean, my work has been looking at the whole situation from different angles, like from the angle of indigenous prophecies, like their understanding of the nature of time and consciousness, you know, cultures like the Hopi and the Maya, which recognize that we were undergoing this kind of prophetic shift, you know, in consciousness. The book that I'm finishing now, which is coming out in February, really looks at the ecological crisis as a initiation or a rite of passage for humanity as a whole, that will either trigger us to reach another level of consciousness as a species, or we probably really won't make it on the planet.
You know, that's kind of draconian.
Well, I mean, I think it's very true if we look at, like, what's happening, like, for instance, species extinction. There's like 10% of the remaining biodiversity disappearing like every year. Every 10 years.
Yeah.
100, 150 species a day. You know, we have ocean acidification. The oceans are like 30% more acidic than they were 40 years ago. And then we have the threat of a, you know, rapid climate change, you know, the potential for it to trigger, you know, to a much higher temperature level due to like the methane under the Arctic and so on. So I think all this stuff is like a forcing mechanism, which is going to force us to shift from competition, aggression, domination as kind of our civilizational paradigms, mm-hmm, to cooperation and symbiosis.
And, well, see, I would go along with you there, except I'm looking at political fragmentation, and I'm looking at so-called leadership, which is basically saying, hate the other, be afraid of the other, be terrified of the other. So that's not cohesion. That's not assimilation in a community. That's fragmentation on a planetary scale.
But of course, but the thing is that there needs to be like a kind of breakdown of the current structures so we can develop, you know, new structures that actually will work for us, you know, because we have to think about how, like, the current form of governments that we have, you know, were really only developed in the late 18th century. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's actually very, very recent. And, you know, we actually don't really have democracy yet. I mean, to talk about, for instance, Brexit, you know, you could look at the EU in some ways as a very undemocratic institution, kind of a, you know, representative of like the New World Order, kind of neoliberal agenda.
Well, we've had historians on the show who actually compared it to the Austro-Hungarian Empire almost point for point for point, because it is not democratic. The EU is not democratic at all.
I mean, they've done things like they've appointed, you know, leaders to like Portugal and Greece, you know, who are like from Goldman Sachs and so on. You know, so it's funny. In a way, I feel like I understand that maybe the British were exiting EU for the wrong reasons. But actually, in some ways, you know, it's necessary to have this challenge for this.
When you say for the wrong reasons, what do you mean?
Well, it seems like the main reason people wanted to go was like fear of immigration and maybe a sense they no longer control their own destinies as much. But it seems a lot of it was fear-based, mm-hmm. Rather than just recognizing that, you know, the EU represented kind of this dysfunctional neoliberal order. You know?
Well, but wait. I would say that it's the dysfunctionality and the distant autocracy that created in Britain a climate that, you know, let's take care of our own house. Forget those folks. We know what we're doing. We need to do it again.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, many things.
In other words, what Tip O'Neill said decades ago: all politics is ultimately local.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so many things are operating simultaneously, and it is very complex. That's why I think it's very helpful to step back and try to get a systemic perspective. You know, and one of the touchstones for my work, you know, over the last years has been like Buckminster Fuller, you know, in his understanding that, you know, if we look at our technical capacities, you know, we have the ability to make a shift, you know, to a world that even works for everybody.
Now, there was a planetary thinker. Didn't he say one time, you know, why should we be charging for power? The sun doesn't charge us.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think he's one of the most relevant remaining thinkers today. And we see his ideas being picked up, you know, in so many ways from, you know, William McDonoghue's work with Cradle to Cradle, you know, kind of looking at how we could redesign our industrial systems so they mesh with the ecology of the earth, you know, or, you know, thinkers around how we have to change the economic system, like Bernard Lyotard about the future of money, you know. So, So there is the potential for system change.
Well, what's interesting to me, Daniel, is that you and I and a lot of other people we know, people like Jay Widener. Hi, Jay. We've all been activists in various fields, and we've all been doing our thing, and we've all said, I'm sure you've said to yourself, I could be more happy and make more money going into storm windows than what I'm doing. I'm not being appreciated. No one's following. Nothing's changing. It's getting worse and worse and worse. And then comes this Brexit thing, when I've been saying for decades now, we need a game changer. Is Brexit a game changer that so opens the system, puts so many assumptions in free fall, like the banking systems, that there now is a wedge, an opening for all kinds of other change? We needed this wedge to get people to pay attention to the list of authors that you just talked about?
I think it's possible. I mean, in England, there's definitely a movement on the left kind of emerging, which is looking at how, you know, we would construct like a post-capitalist society. There's a wonderful book called Post-Capitalism by Paul Mason, and another book called Inventing the Future by two very interesting authors. And they're basically, their argument is that the left's demands have not been radical at all or enough, and that we should really be thinking about, instead of demanding like more employment and, you know, more work, full employment, the demand should be for complete unemployment, for a post-work society, you know, where automation actually takes care of the drudgery.
Wait. I saw a major story just the other day on that. Someone is looking at this whole now shifting thing, you know, the upper tenth of 1%, the oligarchies, the those that have, those that don't have, the missing middle class. the fact that jobs are not there. It's not that people aren't getting them. They're just not there because of robotics, because of AI, because of technology. So I forget who it was that brought this up the other day and floated it out there. Maybe we should have, in the U.S., now they're just talking about us, a guaranteed national income, a floor that we would then build upon. You wouldn't suppress your creativity, your entrepreneurship. If you want to be another Donald Trump, God bless you. But for those that don't have that, that fall through the cracks for so many systemic reasons, the idea now of having a floor, an economic floor, so having a job is secondary to what you want as opposed to primary to how you survive, that seems to be coming back. I haven't heard words like this since Daniel Patrick Moynihan.
Yes, I think that the idea that we need some type of universal basic subsidy, you know, not just for people in the
developed world. But don't use the term subsidy. Everything is in language. That's why I hate the term UFOs. And I hate the term free energy. It's breakthrough energy. It's unknown vehicles. It's not, you know, in other words, language is crucial. So don't call it a subsidy, because that's like saying you have to be kept alive by artificial means. No, our birthright is to be alive. What we do with it is afterwards. And that's, so language is crucial. I would not use the word subsidy.
Yeah. So let's say basic income, you know, or maybe it, you know, presages even like a deeper shift in the whole financial system, you know, where we introduce other means to exchange value.
Well, there's a reason I put up Star Trek tonight in my openings, because by moving the Enterprise up to the main hall in the Smithsonian, the establishment of Smithsonian is basically saying Gene's vision should be paid attention to. Part of Gene's vision was you don't have to go out and, you know, dig coal to stay alive. There is a guaranteed reality that you then build upon as part of a, you know, civilized community of people who care for each other as part of civilization.
Yeah, I don't think we've actually seen civilization yet.
No,
no. We may be getting close.
There are hints. I see a glimmer on the horizon, yes.
So, yeah, so in that way I see, you know, from this sort of more systemic perspective, even though I understand it may be difficult for many people in the short term, you know, the breakdowns that are happening, and which I think will continue to happen, you know, may actually be necessary for like a systemic transition. You know?
Well, a lot of people, you know, Dan, you know this, it only takes 2% to have a revolution. The other 98% basically come along for the ride. And if you make enough people uncomfortable, it becomes easier to have the revolution than to stay where you are. And that's what I think Brexit and the sit-down, the amazing sit-down on the House floor by the Democrats, you know, 3 or 4 days ago. And don't think of them as Democrats. Think of them as half of the elected government turned in revolt against the other half and said, you're not dealing with us fairly. The issue was almost immaterial. It was a resurgence of real Democratic, get your act together. We're here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, sure. I mean, anyway, I mean, as I said, I think like trying to understand more like the systemic level of what's happening. You know, I mean, obviously with Brexit, like it was mostly like older voters, and you know, the younger voters were wanting to remain in Europe. You know, so it's just so many things are happening.
But see, once you have a revolution, everybody's going to be swept up in it. So where do we guide it? If you could have your vision of how this could come out for best for everybody, how would it work? What do you see as the best possible outcome, not the fear porn that I see out there all over the world now, because, oh, Britain made a change. They did something unusual.
I think it would be like a rapid, you know, evolution in terms of people's awareness, particularly the wealthy elite to start, that it doesn't have to be this way, and that actually, you know, this ridiculous wealth inequality and everything else is just really like not even good for those people with you know, with the resources, you know? And then, you know, using media to change people's perception, you know, to be more focused on the solutions and the positive aspects that we have, you know, that would be something that could happen. And then using the power of our digital tools and our social technologies to create, like, sharing systems, you know, ways that people can share resources, where the energy can be used more efficiently. You know, all of that is available. It's just first we require like the shift in perception, you know.
Well, everything starts with a shift in perceptions. It's like if you don't think it's possible, it never will be possible. Well, I'm just thinking, again, looking at this from 30,000 feet, the world is in such turmoil now, and this Brexit thing has opened such a gap of possibility, economic, political, even consciousness, is it not a window to try to implement some of the things you and I and a lot of others have discussed for years, because change is now around us. Change is palpable. It's ongoing. We don't have to get it going from nothing. Change is now happening. How about going in the right direction for change?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we're still at the cusp where the alternative is being fleshed out. I mean, if you read, I don't know if you looked at, like, Naomi Klein wrote this book, The Shock Doctrine, and she was talking about how neoliberalism triumphed as an ideology. And she wrote that essentially they really planned it out. Like Milton Friedman said, you know, at some point a crisis is going to come, and when that crisis comes, you know, the ideas that are going to be applied are the ones that are lying around. So then the neoliberals, you know, prepared a whole ideology through, like, a whole set of, like, think tanks and, you know, institutions and media outlets. You know, so when, like, you know, the USSR collapsed in 1989, the neoliberalism was the only ideology that was available. So it kind of rushed into the gap. Mm. So if we're now seeing these things moving towards a breaking point, those people, you know, who want to see a positive change need to kind of get ahead of the problem and put forward a coherent vision and also a way to achieve it.
There appears to be this window, because I've seen now a lot of the people who were kind of behind the Brexit movement, you know, that kind of right-wing political leader, Frang, I think his name is. I'm probably mispronouncing his name. Then there's Johnson, former mayor of London, mm-hmm. who now they're looking at for possible prime minister. The interesting thing, Daniel, is these guys, none of them seem to have a plan for what to do after they won. It's like they all went through all the motions thinking they were not going to win. Something happened, they won, and now there is no plan at all, which means it's an incredible fertile field for plans that might actually work in an environment that no one thought of day before yesterday.
God, Richard, you're getting me so excited. I feel like I should take a plane to London.
You should. In fact, we should join you and do, you know, some shows from there.
Yeah.
So, no, this, to me, remember, this now goes back, in my perspective, to all those rumors around the so-called City of London, that the City of London basically is strangled and has held a kind of primogenitorship of financing all over the world for decade after decade after decade. And suddenly, England is cut off from the main, drifting like an island. The City of London now is going to have to deal with Europe the way it does from a foreign country, as opposed to in a position of leadership. And it's like everything has been thrown up in the air, all the jack straws are floating, and we could make it come down much closer to what we want if we know this is the opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. Richard, you know, so I haven't really been following, you know, your work recently, your show. I know the Moon book I read and was fascinated by, and I know your work on Mars. I mean, you know, some people are saying that Hillary Clinton is going to release data on, like, extraterrestrials and so on.
Well, the weird thing is a major candidate running for the highest office in the land, one might argue on the planet at the moment, has now several times, 2-3 times, and her campaign manager, John Podesta, has raised the issue of UFOs, government secrecy, Area 51. She's talking about opening things up, setting up a panel, you know, mm-hmm. within the bounds of national security. I have looked at this and my colleagues for months now as leading up to the magic D word, disclosure, mm-hmm. that for some reason the powers that be have conspired behind the scenes to put us on a timeline, on a kind of a calendar, where at some point, date uncertain to us at the moment, they will admit, oh my God, look what's out there. And Hillary's campaign proclamations repeatedly during the primary is part of that run-up to that amazing event. With Brexit now overturning the world politically and economically, it just seems to me that the ground is fertile for all kinds of new announcements like, oh, you know, we kind of forgot to tell you, but such and such is actually real.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they do it under the guise of all kinds of other revolution, they won't get shot for not telling us the truth on one particular item. There's too much. It's like a, you know, the drinking from the proverbial fire hose.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess, like, you know, I mean, in the 2012 book, I kind of correlated the time that we're in, not only with the Hopi prophecies, but the Judeo-Christian, you know, concept of the apocalypse. And that apocalypse is a word that really means, like, uncovering or
revealing.
Yes,
it means revelation.
So it's a time when everything that was hidden becomes known and available.
Have you noticed how many political people, and even non-political people, people that you deal with every day, friends, whatever, they can't avoid telling the truth? They make these most amazing pronouncements, like Jim Carrey in that famous movie that I so love, Liar, Liar. It's like everybody now is telling the truth, and people are lining up depending upon which truth teller they are looking at. Like there's a whole Trump cadre that don't care that he can't tell the truth. They want something so radically different, they're willing to tie their star to him because he's the only change agent they see.
Yeah. Yeah, Trump's a sort of painful thing to contemplate. But
unless you see what he's revealing, because it's not him, it's the people who want what he's offering. Even if he could never provide it, they want what he's offering, so why don't other folks give it to them?
Mm-hmm.
Like the real stuff, real truth, real evidence, real change, real revolution, like this guaranteed national income. Wouldn't that be a great idea?
Isn't that what we've been sort of seeing with Bernie Sanders?
I mean, exactly. The alternate opposite polarity of the options Trump is providing, but with a large dose of sanity. I'm showing my prejudices there. Okay, we are at the top of the hour, actually bottom of the hour. I've got to look at my clock correctly. My guest this morning is Daniel Pinchbeck. We're discussing life and stuff and change. More change coming up. You're on the other side of midnight. And we shall return. I know this music. My guest this morning, Daniel Pinchbeck. We're discussing life, reality, and consciousness and changes. Daniel, at what point, like all of us, did you get to where you look around and you say, they're not telling me what's really going on? I'm being conned. When did that dawning awareness hit you?
Well, I mean, I guess I grew up in a left-wing household. My mother had been editing radical books and movement books. She edited Abby Hoffman's first book, Revolution for the Hell of It. So I sort of grew up in that context of thinking that, there was something off about the government and our military kind of imperial system. And then I went to college. I dropped out. I was working in magazines. And I guess I had like an existential crisis when I was in my late 20s,
mm-hmm.
and had been, basically assumed that the scientific worldview was accurate, and we lived in a materialist world where consciousness was only based in the brain. But this led me to have this sort of crisis of values and nihilism, and I ended up, wanting to explore it. I remembered psychedelic experiences from college as kind of the most profound indicators.
So you went through the Peggy Lee crisis. Is that all there is?
Oh, I don't know. Is that what happened with her?
Yeah, she was a famous singer. She wrote this incredible song, Is That All There Is? That All There Is? Because, if you're dealing only with 3D reality, quote, materialism, you get a finite end stop. But what if the universe is not a finite system? So continue, please.
Yeah, so then I was doing some pieces. I wrote a piece. I got very interested in ecological subjects. I wrote a piece for Esquire that was actually about the rapid decline of the human sperm count.
This is why you were in college?
No, this was after I dropped out. This was when I was working as a freelance writer and editor.
So you were you were on the trail. You were searching.
Yeah, and that sort of just led me to a deeper reflection into. Why could people of my generation not face kind of what was happening ecologically? And I began to realize that it was deeply connected to like our spiritual sort of emptiness, like our sense of there really not being, like anything outside of like brain-based consciousness. So that reminded me that I'd had these psychedelic experiences in college. I decided now that I was an adult and a journalist that I would go out and explore that So I started to get some assignments. I took ayahuasca in a ceremony downtown Manhattan. And then ultimately I went to West Africa, and I went through a tribal initiation in the Bumi tribe of Gabon, taking Iboga, which is a long-lasting psychedelic. And that was a very powerful experience and kind of revealed different levels of, like, psychic phenomena that I hadn't anticipated. And then I was just off and running. Like, I ended up going to Amazon in Ecuador, later in Brazil, and visited the Mazatec Indians in Mexico, and wrote about the Burning Man Festival and so on. And so I ended up making a shift in my worldview to kind of accepting this larger dimension of psychic reality that just seemed to be kind of experientially verified, you know, in ceremonies that I had.
Okay, yeah. So did you abandon the scientific view, or did you graft on to that view?
I think ultimately they all cohere.
You believe there is a real metaphysics?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Because we've got data that really supports the consciousness, you know, this is not all there is reality, but that's a whole other conversation, so unless it's relevant. But we've got data. I can support your position because we've got data. Let's go to this book that you wrote based on all this, Breaking Open the Head. It got some really interesting critical reviews because apparently you put together for the first time a lot of stuff that people were feeling but didn't have the guts to write down.
Yeah, I think, you know, part of the value of that book was that it was, you know, personal and also had a, you know, kind of literary style. And then I kind of integrated all this different material ranging from, like, Terence McKenna, you know, and Timothy Leary and kind of psychedelic thinking, Alan Watts, you know, two anthropologists like Claude Levi-Strauss and Michael Harner. And, you know, really, you know, given my best shot to kind of provide, an angle for understanding, you know, the psychedelic experience and how that understanding, you know, ultimately has to enlarge our perception of the world and the universe and the psyche. I mean, what's also been very interesting over the last 10 years since the book came out is the explosion in, you know, psychedelic research and medical research and psychoanalytic, psychological research. And, you know, basically at this point, a huge body of evidence is really supporting the value of psychedelics for many purposes.
Well, the political climate, which is impelling this wave of legalization of marijuana, I mean, I look at this historically at the timing of the marijuana coming out of the closet, the kind of common drug of choice for availability. It's not that expensive. It's pretty safe. There's nobody's ever OD'd on it, that kind of thing. And yet it opens the mind at a time when, as we're reaching this nodal point in the physics, an open mind is on the part of a large part of the electorate is exactly what you want to make the right decisions in this coming window. Again, I look at this as kind of non-coincidental. I think somebody knows this and has been quietly steering us politically to get to this point simultaneously. What do you think?
I don't know about steering us politically. As I said, I look at it more as an evolutionary process. And I think there are reasons to think that it's very much like, you know, kind of the precise and exquisite timing you find in field development, you know, from conception to birth. So there have been, like, these waves of transformation, the, you know, sort of numinous discovery of LSD in 1943, in Basel, Switzerland by Albert Hofmann, you know, which led to the sort of countercultural upsurge of the 60s, you know, the discovery of the internet, the personal computer, and so on.
Mm-hmm. You're basically saying that Steve Jobs and Bill Gates were on LSD when they invented the microprocessor.
Well, I don't even think they invented the microprocessor, but yeah.
Well, but you just said the internet is connected, because that's who did it. Those two guys did it.
It's not exactly. There's many people involved, but
So what you're saying is that wave of open your mind and your heart to...
There's a book about this called What the Dormouse Said.
Ah.
There's actually a couple of books which really look at the influence of LSD and psychedelics on the digital revolution and on the discovery of the internet and so on.
But Daniel, if that's true, those two guys and their trip at some point where they kind of got this vision, they gave us the 21st century. Two guys on a trip gave us... That's what you're saying or implying, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, definitely LSD was, you know, in mushrooms had a lot of importance to the early pioneers of the internet. I mean, that's established in this book, What the Dormouse Said. I don't know if I would go so far as to say that one trip, but yeah. And
I'm being a little, in terms
of what we're discovering in genetics and biology. I mean, like, what's his name? Polymer chain reactions.
What's his name in California?
Carrie Mullis.
Yes.
You know, just discovered polymer chain reactions. You know, he admitted that it was a psychedelic.
In Scientific American, I saw that one. That was pretty cool. So, all right, if that's true, and we've got these incredible geniuses, I mean, do you think Elon Musk does the same thing quietly without telling us? Because if you look at these geniuses and what they've catalyzed for the benefit of billions of other people, imagine if we removed the shackles on the imagination of the other 6.999999 billion.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's beautiful that you say unleash the shackles of the imagination, because that actually is very much like my vision for how the future might unfold, and something that I feel like some of our great artists and prophets like William Blake and Oscar Wilde and so on kind of pointed towards. That, yeah, I mean, if we look at what's happening with our technology, you know, the potential we have to change society for the better, the potential to explore, you know, the psyche and settle other planets, all this stuff. Yeah, it's like the liberation of the imagination, you know, which maybe is what human history has kind of pointed towards.
Or what it should be pointed towards. We've been living under this stupid glass ceiling, and we're about to remove it ourselves. Hopefully.
Yeah, that's the idea of conscious evolution, you know, that I talk about in the new book, and Barbara Marx Hubbard kind of pioneered that phrase.
Ah, good old Barbara. I haven't had Barbara on the show yet. I tried. I came very close, and then she had something else, so we had to reschedule, and we haven't rescheduled. Okay, let me go back. Your psychedelic explorations obviously had a major impact on you. What were some of the hype? What were some of the experiences? What were the ahas that made you go, oh, my God, so this is the way it is?
I mean, that's a big question. I mean, going back to the first Iboga experience in Africa, when I ate the powder, I had, first of all, it was amazing how the shamans knew about all these different aspects of the experience. So first they had me sit in front of a mirror with my eyes open, and I saw these different visions. I saw a vision of the Iboga spirit itself as a body made of wood. And then they had me lie down, and for many hours I went through kind of this journey, sort of through my own early history and past life, seeing like sort of how I'd been, constructed in a way psychologically through my parents breaking up and so on. And so from there, another really significant one was dimethyltryptamine or DMT, NMDMT, which Terence McKenna writes about.
Right.
As many people have now expressed, when you smoke DMT past a certain threshold, you basically lose all contact with this reality. You enter a fully realized kind of hyper-dimensional reality, and you have an impression there of like enormous intelligence and enormous power. That's another experience that definitely suggests that there may be other dimensions, proximate to this one.
Now, as you've done this over your lifetime now, your professional lifetime, have you noticed changes in psychedelic experiences? Are people reporting they have better trips, that they have more expansive trips, they have more imaginative trips, they have fewer fear aspects to trips? In other words, has it been uniform all along, or as the HD model predicts in terms of the physics? Because the physics is changing, there should be a background influence on consciousness, and consciousness should reflect that change almost directly.
So that's actually a very astute and kind of deep question that's actually quite difficult to answer.
We have time.
I mean, I feel like in some ways, more people seem to be having somewhat dark psychedelic experiences.
Oh, no,
particularly
that's interesting.
With LSD. With ayahuasca, when you talk to the shamans, in the Amazon, some of them will say that they feel that because now so many people are doing the medicine in kind of not very evolved contexts or not with the best motivation, that it's actually affecting the field of the medicine and making it sort of cloudier or murkier, so that it's actually harder to kind of break through for them if they want to do a healing. They have to like pass through this level of cloud or murk. So, yeah, I think that there is something like Rupert Sheldrake's ideas of morphogenetic fields or, psychic fields or somehow or other, these experiences are maybe there's a feedback loop between human consciousness collectively as we have these experiences, and then what we're receiving.
Well, again, if this physics is two-way, in other words, you're aware that Art Bell did a consciousness experiment and saved my life many, many, many years ago, like 18 years ago or something, and he did it with a few other people. He tried weather control and all that. I've been looking at this much more, let's say, scientifically, and I now believe there is really interesting data. Dean Radin, the Princeton eggs, our own measurements at down in Central America, Chichen Itza, that there's a definite influence between consciousness and the ways you can measure its influence on the matrix, the ether, whatever that background thing you want to give that name to that keeps us all going. If you can demonstrate influences, then the big thing is, if you collectively imagine the right kind of future, can we, even if it's only a few of us, can we pull off a consciousness heist to where we can direct the curve if the physics is demanding that something fill the vacuum, that some energy form, some matrix be in place? Who's to say that we couldn't make it ours?
I think I understand you, and I think I basically agree with you. You know, and once again, it's this idea that, you know, from where we are now, we have to recognize that, you know, we're not, there's like this inertia of these systems that are pushing us in a certain direction, you know, particularly towards ecological collapse, and somehow we have to find the will to overcome that inertia.
So as you were going through these psychedelics, in your own personal evolution, at what point did you say, this is a tool, but it's certainly not a life?
Well, I mean, for some people, it is a life. I mean, I have friends who are part of the Santo Daime, and for them, it's a regular practice. Like every week, they do, every 2 weeks, they do medicine. You know, so
yeah, but they also do other things. I mean, it's part of their life. It isn't, you know, we see people on drugs as, you know, huddling in some dark alley with a you know, hypodermic, you know, in their veins. That's not what we're talking about at all. We're talking about integrating two realities and using materials to gain access on a more, what, controlled basis.
Yeah, I mean, there could be a whole, you know, evolution of our whole, you know, legal system that would maybe allow for these experiences. I mean, I think that's, you know, something that we're going to see in the next 20 years, as you said, following what's happened with marijuana, you know.
I mean, the marijuana thing, again, it's like the whole LGBT thing. It's like yesterday it was unthinkable, today it's like, who cares? Of course it's, you know, love who you want. It's like marijuana, you know, was this horrible.
And that also, once again, to just take that evolutionary perspective, it has to do with the, you know, the internet and the interactive media, and how, you know, mass resonance happens so quickly, you know, which once again points to the potential for like a tipping point and a planetary transformation.
So you're saying that the internet, the global internet, is kind of taking the place now of Teheran's newsphere.
Well, you're saying that, but yeah, I basically agree. I think it's a step in the right direction. I mean, it's, you know, we're now all intermeshed in a global brain, and we can communicate, you know, ideas, you know, images, techniques, practices instantly. And as the ecological crisis acts as a kind of pressure cooker, I think that global brain is going to become more fully activated.
When you say ecological crisis, are you talking just the global warming situation, or are you talking about all the other stuff that our high-tech civilization is dumping into the environment that no one really knows about?
I think that we've gotten a little fixated on climate change, and that's only one issue. The model is really the planetary boundaries model that the Stockholm Resilience Center put together is maybe the best one, which sees nine, you know, planetary boundaries, which include climate change, species extinction, nitrogen runoff from farming, you know, atmospheric pollution, and ocean acidification. And in fact, ocean acidification, species extinction, and climate change are all probably equally threatening to our future as a species.
So as with any science, it's much more complicated than just, you know, climate change, global warming, that kind of thing. You're saying it's the synergistic effects of not only what we're doing, but what nature is doing?
No, it's all caused by us.
No, wait. It's all caused by us? You don't think there are large natural cycles like in solar output? I mean, there is warming going on Pluto right now, Daniel, which is not due to SUVs.
Okay, so you're talking about Dmitriev and the whole solar system is going.
Yeah, I'm looking at the
transition.
big picture, which is physics changes.
I think that's true, but the problem is that you're looking at it from a dualistic perspective, from a non-dual perspective. What we as humans are doing to this ecology and this environment, is also just something that's in a sense happening, right? Like, in a non-dual perspective. So that's how we're contributing to this high energy transition at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to make a conscious evolution and change what we're doing. We're putting 1 million tons of CO2 into the atmosphere every hour, we know that we've affected the whole ecosystem of the oceans.
Where are you on the whole alternative energy, I hate this term, free energy, breakthrough energy situation?
I mean, if it works, that would be awesome. I mean,
wait a minute. If it works, what do you mean? Please define.
Well, I mean, I've seen this, solar panels work. I've seen power plants work. I've heard tremendous talk from many people in the alternative community about free energy and zero point energy.
Mm-hmm.
I personally have not yet seen a device. I mean, it definitely is possible that there are these devices.
Do you know that there are technologies to break down radioactive half-lives? I saw one demonstrated on Good Morning America live one morning about 20 years ago.
That's great.
The natural uranium breakdown looked 4.5 billion years for uranium half-life to 20 minutes.
So, I'm definitely very interested in all sorts of free energy. But the fact is that we also might be on the cusp of what some people are calling a solar singularity, whereas solar becomes cheaper than, traditional sources, we can then use distributed manufacturing to, convert the whole world to a solar grid, in a few decades. And if these free energy devices then come along and allow us to move even faster, that's fantastic.
Or they may be synergistic. The political climate around solar is such now that it's opened the mindset to people to think of even more interesting revolutions so that the two could synergize each other. But yeah, you're right. It's now becoming to where it's cheaper than to basically print solar cells on a substrate than it is to print a major newspaper. That's how the technology is moving at Warp 9. So you might see all kinds of little huts and villages all over Africa and South America and Australia and all that with little, paper solar cells on their thatched roofs, each one providing power for a little solid-state refrigerator and light at night, LEDs and computers, and they bring those distant places into the 21st century just like that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the potential for creating like a really like regenerative social design model where people are able to create their own power, grow their own food, and so on.
How do we keep the big institutions, a la the World Bank and the Central Bank of England and a whole bunch of other folks like that, from mucking it up? Because this kind of technology is not new. It's been around since the 50s, and yet no one's really pushed it because of oil, because of coal, because of gas, because of fossil fuels, which are finite, and you can't tame the sun. Every time you put out a panel, bingo, it will give you energy.
Yeah, I mean, we know that there are different ways that, paradigms change. There's, revolutions, there's dissolutions, there's supersessions, so we don't know exactly how this could happen, but how it's going to happen, but we can certainly map out where it could go and also how beneficial that would be really to everybody. And then try to sort of, kind of impel it in that direction, I guess.
See, one of the problems I see with the global future is that you've got the developed world and you've got the underdeveloped world. Then you have places kind of like in between, China. And we're trying to say environmentally, wait a minute, you guys can't do what we did because you're going to muck up the planet totally. And they say, wait a minute, you got yours, now you don't want us to have ours, we're going to get ours anyway, forget your nonsense about the planet. So what's the middle ground? Because both positions are right, in a sense. How do we get the underdeveloped folks to join the human race without killing the planet in the process?
Well, I've definitely given this a lot of thought. And I think that it would actually require, on the part of the developed world, beginning with the wealthy elites, you know, kind of a time of personal sacrifice, you know, where they would have to sort of admit that, you know, it's been disproportional and that we were now going to go through a series, you know, a period where we would readjust and balance out, you know. So how could that happen? You know, potentially could happen through social contracts that people sign on the internet. You know, people in the first world saying, well, you know, I'm not going to take this trip this year. And, you know, I'm going to give up, you know, this car or this luxury, you know. You know, in a sense, it has to become a little bit like the spirit of England in the Second World War, and that sense of sacrifice for the greater good. And then if you look back at that period, you know, we find that many people who lived through it remember that period of sacrifice as the most beautiful part of their lives.
Well, because they were part of a larger reality. It was, you know, it was their lives against something larger than themselves. And that always, that kind of appeals to the better angels. The problem now is that we don't see leadership appealing to our better angels. We see an awful lot of hate, an awful lot of fear, an awful lot of get behind me, I'll solve all your problems because I know what I'm doing and you don't.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a mess right now, Richard. You're not gonna make me disagree with that.
Okay. Well, we're looking for solutions this morning. In a couple minutes, we have a station break, and then we come back, and we have 5 minutes. I'm going to bring in my friend from England at that point, who is a familiar name, but it's not the same guy. So don't worry about that. His name is Howard Hughes. He is one of the presenters on the BBC. I've known him for decades. He also looks at various other things, and we'll be talking to him in a couple of minutes. Daniel, before we go to the break, this transition that you took personally, it ultimately wound you up in the heart of Manhattan, the most densely populated city in North America, with all kinds of very non-environmental friendly technologies all around you. How come that's where you ended up?
I have no idea.
And here I thought there was a master plan.
I mean, in some ways, New York is a perfect place to be if you're trying to get a message out to the world.
Oh, sure.
Because it's a transmitting station, you know.
But it's one heck of an example of the things that you don't want to be setting examples for.
Well, yeah, you can look at it different ways.
I mean, let me interrupt myself there. The one thing I love about New York is it's so community-based. It's like you can go anywhere in New York, and if you're in New York, people will recognize you. It's like New York is almost like a small town in some weird ways.
Yeah, I mean, many things are fantastic about New York. I love the neighborhood I live in. I love the community gardens. And, you know, people who live in cities are actually often considered to be ecologically kind of better, you know, better contributors than people who live in suburbs who drive long distances and so on. Hmm. So, you know, dense cities where food is grown and energy is produced, you know, is probably part of the solution for the future.
Okay. All right. We are at the top of the hour. We're going to take a brief break, do station ID, and then come back with my guest. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. Howard has called in. And we are back on the other side of midnight. You know, I looked at our little widget the other day, which is at the top right corner of our homepage, theothersideofmidnight.com. And you can see that little globe spinning and all those flickering, blinking lights. As of this morning, we are in 115 countries on that globe tonight, this morning, this afternoon, whatever you are on that spinning planet. So let me welcome my old friend, Howard Hughes from the BBC and many other things. Howard, how is it there in sunny England this morning?
Well, the one thing that is positive, Richard, is that it's sunny. That's the only positive thing. All the rest is up in the air and is complete chaos, really, as I tuck into my breakfast here and try not to think about it too much.
Are you guys really going through these conniptions? I mean, we're watching this from across the pond, and there's some of us saying, wait a minute, the sterling's going to come back, the banks will come back, people will reinvest, the $2 trillion that disappeared didn't really disappear, it'll come back like it came back here. if people just take kind of a deep breath, but it's like everyone's going into a tizzier fit, and no one's taking any deep breaths.
Well, yes. I mean, that's a very good summation, actually, Dick. The difficulty that we've got here is that when we've had crises of various kinds in the past, the answer to the question has usually been, yes, it will sort itself in 3 months, or yes, we'll know the answer to this after a general election. Unfortunately, all of the experts and all of the people who were so free with their views in this country on the media before the big referendum vote, a lot of them conspicuous by their absence, and those who do appear on the media are saying, we don't know. So literally, the answer to most questions, other than what day of the week is this, and sometimes I doubt that, the answer to most questions you may ask at the moment is, we simply don't know.
When we did our Brexit show last week, kind of pre the vote, a couple days before the vote, maybe one day before the vote, one of the things we were asking, is this going to be an honest vote? If you look at conspiracy theories, there is this perception that the world is now controlled by invisible hands, invisible bankers, basically banksters, as my friend Joe Farrell calls them, and that they would decide, that because the polling was so even, almost like 50-50, that if someone wanted to push it in one direction or another, it would be relatively easy to steal the election and to force politically what would then happen. When the Leave folks won, the consternation, the shock, the ultimate panicked deer in the headlights, Bambi in the headlights view of people even like Johnson, who's now in line to maybe become the new prime minister, it looks like nobody, Howard, on the Leave side actually thought they had a snowball's chance on the Sun side of Mercury, so they didn't do any planning.
They didn't. Well, it appears they didn't. If they didn't tell us they'd done planning and they have, then it's about time for them to come out and say, okay,
but Cameron himself
said, here's the plan.
But see, Cameron that morning said, well, I'm not going to do anything for 3 months till I leave. That means nobody did any planning.
Well, it does and it doesn't. We don't know what goes on behind the corridors of Westminster or within the corridors of Westminster here. Anything could have happened. I think the difficulty that we've got as ordinary citizens here, and even ordinary citizens who go on the radio and do news like I do, is a lot of us simply do not know what is happening because we haven't had a full update. What we do know is that we're being told by Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, who is a Canadian, and it seems to be a straight-up guy who's done a pretty good job, they say. We're told that there is plenty of money to cover any contingencies here, but meantime, shares, stocks in a lot of big companies are sliding. One of the big banks, Barclays, badly affected yesterday, so much so that for a period, it, and I think another bank, HSBC, I think, but I would need to check that, had to suspend trading in shares yesterday for a while, which is a big and serious thing to do.
I tell you what, hold it there. We're almost five after. I'm going to hold you over so that Daniel can ask a question or two. My friend Howard Hughes from the BBC, from the heart of the explosion this morning, London. You're on the other side of midnight, and we shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight at just after the 2 a.m. hour here in the Land of Enchantment under a gorgeous sky this evening. It's been very hot, and today the weather finally broke, and it's now almost civilized. So, Patrick, good weather is heading your way. Howard, if I was to walk down some wonderful street like that great restaurant we found on the banks of the Thames one night, you and me and Robin, in the middle of a rainstorm, a French restaurant there on the banks of the Thames, if we went back to that restaurant, would we see people jumping out of the tower windows? Would we see people throwing themselves in the Thames? Would we see the bridge tower up and all the sirens and the flickering lights? Or is London tonight, like London normally is, even during the Blitz, mustering on?
Depends on whether you work in the financial area of the City of London or not. A lot of people there are very concerned because there is still dark talk of some businesses, including some American ones, who have their European headquarters in the financial district and do financial trades with all of Europe, of those companies relocating to maybe Frankfurt or somebody like that, or somewhere like that, and taking with them jobs possibly in the thousands. Now look, let's add the caveat. None of this has happened yet.
And it's not going to happen until Cameron says Article 50 is triggered or something.
Well, yes. I mean, there is that. We have this interregnum because, look, it's like quitting a job, isn't it? You haven't quit your job until you've typed out a note for your boss and given it to him or her.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, we haven't sent the resignation letter in. And the Europeans, some of them are saying, where's this resignation letter? We're waiting for it because we want to get a move on here and shore up our own house.
Okay, in terms of metaphors, the resignation letter or the divorce decree is kind of like, as I explained it with our audience last week, you had a referendum which basically says to Parliament, we want to leave. Now, Parliament has to take the next step and actually leave, right? And the terms of the leaving are under the Prime Minister to negotiate till Parliament can ratify a leaving agreement. And none of that gets set in motion until Cameron decides to call the question on Article 50. And he has said categorically he's not going to do it till what? September, October?
Well, yes, it's now being put forward. The latest estimate is the very beginning of September, but there is talk also that there may be a general election. Look, there are as many permutations of this situation as you want to create. There is a permutation of this situation that says the current government will hold a general election to elect a new prime minister, who would be, of course, the leader of the ruling Conservative Party, David Cameron's replacement. But they would make as one of the central pillars of this election that we are staying in the EU. That is just one thing that is being touted around at the moment. Now, I'm not sure whether that's going to happen because at the moment, I am barely sure that tomorrow is Wednesday. It is Wednesday tomorrow, isn't it? You know, it's very, very difficult to predict. But life goes on here. You asked if there were signs of fear and panic and concern. There's some mild concern. But look, I always gauge things by my local supermarket. We have a chain here called Tesco's. It's the biggest in the UK. And there's a local one round here, and I was there yesterday. And I was walking down the aisles like you do, and I heard a couple of people muttering slightly about it, but nothing too serious. And then a woman appears, and in the loudest, poshest English voice says, and clearly she has her priorities set, she's saying, "Do you know, I don't think we've got enough cake." I think that tells us a hell of a lot about what's going on. The British will always come through whatever the situation is. Have I ever lived through times like this? No.
Wow.
I don't know what.
But Howard, being a journalist in the middle of the eye of the hurricane, you obviously have been, your prayers to the sky gods of media have been answered. You're in the middle of where it's going on.
Yes. But I'm a human being too, and so are all of my colleagues in the various places that I work these days, and all of them are a little concerned. The younger ones, of course, are very concerned that the future for their kids is uncertain. They won't get the chance to study abroad. We won't be in this great big single trading block. But look, who knows? There was somebody, I listened to everything.
Howard, hang on a sec.
Yeah.
Do real rational people there in England this morning,
yeah,
do they really think substantively, now that they've reached this far, that it's really going to go back to the 1930s or the 1920s or the teens when France and England were mustering huge armies and Germany was plotting? I mean, why don't they just decide what the future is they want and then do it?
It's nothing is as easy as that is the scenario that we're looking at here.
But see, that sounds like those folks who want to keep you in the EU. It's almost like it's the retro plan B. If they vote in terms of this crazy thing, we'll do everything we can to make sure it never gets implemented because we'll scare the bejesus out of them before they can actually vote.
Well, every so often I turn on the radio and I'm listening to everything all the time, including stations from the US, and I hear a politician here saying, it's the will of the people and whatever happens, we have to enact it. Well, I thought that was how it was meant to work. But then I also hear people saying, well, how can we work a fix here? How can we maybe have another referendum, or how can we maybe have a general election, or do something that means that this actually doesn't happen? It's like forestalling your trip to the dentist. You know, how can we make sure that we don't go to the dentist today? Well, we can put white toothpaste over the little dark bits on our teeth, and then the dentist may not notice, which is just a metaphor that I've conjured up from absolutely nowhere. I mean, the truth of it is, if you're looking for definitive information about where we're going, you can ask me today. You can probably ask the Prime Minister, and our views will probably be the same. I don't know. All bets are off. It is, on one level, exciting, and on another level, it's absolutely terrifying. I think, to some degree, we're being punished as a nation, and this is just a personal view. It's not a view of any organization that I work for. I think that the financial institutions and what have you externally, those who trade in currencies most importantly, are making us pay for this. But don't forget there are people who've made a payday out of this. The currency traders, some people who hedged their bets, did whatever jiggery-pokery they do. I was reading in the paper on Saturday when I was on the radio, you know, that there are a couple of people who've made a small fortune out of all of this.
So far. Well, Donald Trump said he was going to make a killing at Turnberry.
Yes, well, yeah, well, we'll see. I mean, that actually, his visit over here, you know, there are some people who don't like him over here.
We heard that rumor, yes.
Yeah, there were expected to be all sorts of demonstrations and stuff. All of that was overshadowed. There were some photographs that I saw of the Donald here, but really...
Well, did you see the one kid spreading golf balls with little Nazi crosses on them in front of his podium right before he took...
But we've had other things in the main to think about these last few
years. Yeah.
And I've never known a period in my life, not even when Diana died, and you know, God rest her soul, I was on duty on that day, and I told London that Diana had died, and the nation went into 7 days of extraordinary behaviour. But I don't think we've ever had a situation where there is only one topic on every television show, on every radio news show. If I turn on the radio now, I've got the radio on in the kitchen just behind me here. There's only one topic. Nobody is talking about anything else.
So it is the game changer, and the question now is how to make it a good one. Daniel, do you have any questions for Howard this morning?
So I've heard that a lot of the financial people are now thinking they're going to have to move to Europe. Is there a sense that the City of London's financial area is going to be evacuated?
Evacuated, no. There will always be business there. Look, I've got some very good friends there, some of whom I do little bits of media training work for and stuff like that. Of course, they're all concerned. Being the City of London, and I'm sure Wall Street is exactly the same.
For people who may not know what we're talking about, define the City of London, okay?
City of London, the square mile, as they call it, because it is a square mile, is the premier financial area other than Wall Street in the world. Everybody looks to London to set the trend. A lot of very important international people are here doing their business, and it's become the heart of the European financial system as well. So it's terribly important. Will it be evacuated? No, it won't. But none of them know what's going on. I think we're waiting for a steer from the people who we elected to run our government. And that is something that we're not really getting. We're being calmed now. We're being told, you know, we'll make a plan, we may have to take a hit in the short term, and all the rest of it. But the headline here is that the people have spoken. This was their verdict. If the politicians didn't expect this verdict, then they're not very good politicians.
You know, what's so amazing is during the Cold War, and now I'm going to talk like a Cold War baby, you know, who did duck and cover and all that, we learned as part of this national crisis, us versus the Soviet Union, the Cold War, maybe thermonuclear annihilation, you know, without warning. We learned that the government plans for everything. Everything. They spend money, they throw money. You know, there is a scenario, there's a document, a folder somewhere in the Pentagon, I was told, literally that charted out what we would do in the case of an invasion of the homeland by Canada. All right? How absurd, right? So how come Cameron and his buddies did not say, okay, it may not work. This whole ploy may not work. What the hell happens if they actually vote for this? If we can't control it, what do we do? There appears to have been no planning, which to me is insanity, unless they were so convinced they were going to win, meaning they were going to fake it, and the real vote caught them totally by surprise.
Well, I don't know about the faking it plan. There was a lot of dark talk about that. And I think the fact that the Leave got the majority by 52%, the Leave side of it, probably gives the lie to that. I think the thing that's caught everybody by total surprise and shock is that this is like a multi-level game of chess, like they play on Star Trek. There are so many dimensions to it. I mean, look, today's news, I've got it in front of me here. I've got Sky News would say the same, and it's Fox, the Fox equivalent here. But the BBC is saying David Cameron will meet European leaders for the first time since the UK voted to leave the EU. Today as the European Parliament debates the implications of Brexit. What's today? It's Tuesday. They're doing it today. I would have thought they would convene an emergency meeting over the weekend.
Wouldn't
they
you think? Have you looked at those graphs? The pound is like, you know, the shuttle in free fall, and they're waiting till Wednesday to meet.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's all bizarre. Plus, there are other factors.
When you say bizarre, my conspiracy bump goes ding, ding, ding. Daniel, is it bizarre or is it planned?
It doesn't seem very planned to me, Richard.
Okay. So we're looking at real confusion, Daniel. That's what you're saying.
It looks like confusion.
Which is the kind of confusion that autocrats who never think they're going to make a mistake always make when they make a mistake, and then they go, oh, my God. It's like these guys really are caught with their pants down.
Now, I have to dissociate myself from any of the organizations that I freelance for, okay, right now. So I'm speaking as me, as a broadcaster and a guy who does that online show, The Unexplained, that I do. So this is me.
Okay.
I think our politicians have not been up to this task. They've been very good at the rhetoric, and some of them have been very good at the speaking. A few of them haven't been very good at that. In terms of making plans and making decisions, they've been conspicuously lacking. There is another dimension to all of this. The Labour Party, the opposition in this country, have a leader called Jeremy Corbyn.
We've been watching him very closely, yes.
Well, Jeremy Corbyn, there was another supposed example of people power where the grassroots membership of the Labour Party voted for him to be the leader. The sharp-suited wearing MPs, most of them, a lot of them, don't want him, and they're trying to get him out. So he's now facing a no-confidence motion. They've turned around and blamed him because they've said, Jeremy, if you stood up and made a clearer case for staying in the European Union, we wouldn't be on our way out of it, and it's all your fault. Maybe that's a harsh judgment. There were many factors at play here, and he was just one of them. And what have we got now? 27 minutes ago here on one of my UK news sites, the Chancellor George Osborne, the man with his hands on the money, says life will not be economically rosy. Well, I think we've seen a little bit of evidence of that with tumbling share prices. The question for all of us who have to, you know, eke out a living in this world, is how far is this going to go? If it's a punishment, if it is a mere market reaction, if it's a dent in economic confidence around the world, in us, how long will this continue for and how far will it go? Because don't forget, if we have a storm here, its effects are felt elsewhere, including in your country.
Absolutely.
That's all very well for some of the talk show hosts who I listen to, like Michael Savage playing the British National Anthem and saying, well done, you Brits. But what happens now? That's the question.
Well, one of the immediate questions is the relationship between the UK and the rest of Europe. Are we talking now in the worst case scenario where Europe will have to negotiate individual country treaties with England on everything, like from the ground up?
No, there is a European free trade area, and we can negotiate ourselves a pass into the European Union. We can be like other states, you know, on the continent and have a semi-detached relationship with the EU, but then that comes with a price.
Would that be kind of like observer status?
Well, yes, it is. I mean, you don't get a say in anything, but you have to pay a bit and you have to allow free access to your country. And that was one of the big issues here, immigration. So you have to keep allowing people in as part of that kind of...
But see, there's been a lot of confusion because the immigration crisis that Britain is facing, I don't think is really pegged to the Syrian problem and the 4 million refugees. It's more the inter-European migration between the continent and the island and back, that kind of relationship.
Yeah, which is only roughly half of it. The other half is people from other places. So I don't think it was properly explained that if immigration is a situation here and the population is rapidly rising and there is pressure on services, but then immigrants bring with them benefits. They pay taxes. They contribute to the economy. That's the other side of it.
They bring skills.
They bring skills that we need. But then one of the other arguments for the Leave campaign was that we have to accept people who may not be as good as people from outside the European Union because in some areas, in many areas, they have to be given precedence, which is why, for example, a nurse phoned a phone-in that I heard before the vote, and she said, at my hospital, all of the nurses in the staff room speak Portuguese and some of them can't read the forms in the hospital. And that is because we had to give precedence and preference to nurses from the European Union. There were nurses from other places like India or wherever with good English skills, but we can't have them because we have to give precedence to people in the European Union. Truly, I listened to all the arguments. I got a big headache. I don't know what to believe, and I still don't, which is a great position for a journalist to be in.
I was going to say, if you don't know, all you can do is read your copy.
Yes, but it means also that I get to ask the hard questions of all sides here. What I'm looking for are answers. What I'm looking for, and this goes for all of them, a plague on all their houses, is leadership. We must see leadership.
Okay, we're hearing over here. We heard it the other morning when we had a couple of British nationals, my friend Bob and my friend Tim, and they were making noises about a woman who apparently is head of the Home Office, who we don't hear anything about. And I started hearing mainstream news today looking to her as maybe the new PM.
This is Theresa May.
Yes.
Yes, I mean, Theresa May was rumoured before the vote to be, you know, not that fond of Europe, but she was on the Remain side during it all. She is now being touted over and above Boris Johnson to be the next leader of the Conservative Party, and that means possibly the next Prime Minister. Well, she would be if she was elected right now, because obviously that post is vacant and the Conservatives are still in power, so she would be Prime Minister.
Guys, you understand what you just said here, Howard? If there is a leading woman in Britain who could be, as a dark horse candidate, the gal to basically be elected, she'd be elected by the Conservative Party, right?
Yeah.
To be the PM of the Tories, right? Mm. Okay. While over here, the big news today was Hillary Clinton going out on the stump with Elizabeth Warren as a potential running mate. My model, remember the HD model for what's going on now, says that symbolism and ritual symbolism by those folks trying to control at the edges behind the scenes is going to be visible by its visible fingerprints. This is the year of the woman. This is the year of ISIS, not the pseudo-terror group, but the real ISIS. And so the idea that a woman is being quietly suddenly proposed as a new PM in the wake of this game changer, this is not trivial, guys.
I don't know about this, Richard, because I don't think people think in terms
of
a person, a woman, or a man.
People
don't. We had Margaret Thatcher here.
No, I'm talking about something which is much deeper at a level of resonance.
I know you're talking about a symbolic thing that we need a woman to ride to the rescue.
I'm saying that a woman arising at the right time to be that person, it's not part of a conscious effort, it's part of an unconscious subliminal phasing of the physics of consciousness in this moment when a woman at the helm seems to be what's being asked for.
Well, I think it's partly a reflection of the fact that the Conservative Party is looking all around it to see who's come out of this unscathed and who has a good track record, and her name comes up at the head of the list.
Mm.
That's it. Whether she'd been woman, man, whatever, I think she would still, or if she was a he, would still come at the top of that list, because few people are coming out of this clean.
Few people.
Well, I would say whoever you listen to, whoever you look at, you know, everybody has made statements or done something, and you know, everybody's tarnished by this.
Interesting. Daniel, anything else?
In one way or another.
Daniel?
Daniel, are you there? He's gone to sleep. I'm that exciting.
I don't think so. It's usually the unmuting.
But, you know, look, I wish, Richard, I was able to sit here with my breakfast in front of me in London in the sunshine, telling you that the answers are beginning to emerge, but the truth is they're not. We might get a little bit more light after Mr. Cameron's meeting with the European Union today. I am surprised this has happened on a Tuesday. Perhaps all sides wanted time to take this in and have some semblance of an idea of what to do. But I do hope that if he has got an idea of where we go next from here, we get to hear about it in some kind of news conference at the back end of today.
Well, one of the interesting indicators then is that this was such a shock to everybody that literally there were no plans, and meeting over the weekend would have been pointless because they just basically would have stood around and said, what the hell are we going to do?
So we needed, Richard, the people who put us in this situation, and that's all of them from all the sides, to speak to us in detail and depth over the weekend. And I know it was a weekend, and, you know, people like to do nice things. Boris Johnson, I think, played golf or cricket. Or he played cricket at the weekend, which is very British and very,
very
nice.
Very British. Hey, Howard, thank you so
people
much.
To speak to us. But anyway, you know, I'll report back to you. I'll let you know what happens when I know.
Well, yeah, by all means, you know, keep us on the hotline, because, look, the Emerald Isle, Britain, the seeing newspaper accounts saying this is the end of Britain, to me, that's so upended, and I'm not, you know, an Anglophile in any way, but I think this is the resurgence, the beginning maybe of a renaissance, once England realizes, oh my God, we're England. It's almost like for the last 20, 30 years, guys, you haven't realized you're England. And that's what I find interesting. And again, we will find out more. Howard, I want to thank my friend Howard Hughes this morning for joining us from England, directly from the center of the hurricane, the center of the storm. We will talk to him soon. You're on the other side of midnight. When we come back, we'll return to my friend Daniel and resume looking at the bigger picture of consciousness. You're on the other side of midnight, and we shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight. Well, that is remarkable what's going on in London and in England as a whole and in terms of the continent because, again, Daniel, it seems to me this is like, you know, taking a piece of a twig and kind of digging into an anthill and stirring it around and watching everybody kind of go crazy. It's like this tells me this was not planned, which means there's the opportunity for real freedom if someone activist-wise gets involved.
Yeah, that would be the great hope. And, you know, there are definitely movements happening around Europe that are very interesting, like the Podemos movement in Spain is one of them. And there are also new tools that could really help people have more, like, direct democracy. Like, there's one tool from New Zealand called Lumio, which is being used as the organizational tool for for the Podemos movement. And yeah, we're seeing the same thing in Bernie Sanders' movement and the grassroots potential. And now people just start talking to each other and calling each other. And suddenly somebody who was like a total outsider and a long shot, you know, wins 22 states. So yeah, we're definitely in a time when exponential change is possible in a way it never was before.
How do you see what's going on with Sanders and Clinton and this coming election?
How do I see it?
Yeah,
I
mean, in other words, where do you think we're ultimately going to wind up?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not a political analyst in that sense. I mean, I thought Bernie Sanders was very noble and courageous, and it was very profound to hear somebody basically just speak, you know, what they thought was the truth. It also really has shown up Hillary even more clearly as kind of very compromised, corrupt. You know, very hard to, you know, cast any kind of vote for her, let alone like an enthusiastic one. So, yeah, it's going to be super interesting to see what happens.
What if she chose Warren as her VP?
It's just like, you know, I'm actually just, it's just not my thing, man. I'm not that interested. I don't really care, to be honest. I mean, I care about, you know, system change, the sort of ecological design viewpoint. And, you know, on the other side, I care about, you know, the world of the psyche, astral worlds and so on. Whoever Hillary chooses as her running mate at this point doesn't personally matter to me at all.
But if you I know you are an activist, I mean, how can you create change without going through the political process?
Well, I mean, activist, I mean, what I created with Evolver, we tried to create a movement. We had like 40 or 50 local groups who were exploring these kind of paths to transformation. I mean, if you look at, like, I think it was Einstein who said that you can never solve a problem, you know, with the same mindset that created it. You have to make a jump, you know, to another level of consciousness. I mean, I think that's really the circumstance. It's like, you know, getting into these things. It's like chewing on, you know, undigestible concrete, and people just spin around and around, and the same phrases get said, and, you know, these same questions. You know, it's just, it doesn't have any, I mean, you know, the fact is the whole machinery of our government system is out of date, right? It was created in the 18th century when, you know, horse and buggies scooter ships were as fast as things could move, and you couldn't really have, you know, a really participatory democracy, just you know, the way things were. So now we find ourselves in a different, you know, framework. You know, could have a different result.
Well, you said a few minutes ago that you felt that the acceleration and change and progress in the LGBT community was in part due to social media, that there was the ability of the electorate, the body politic, to connect and to connect with political powers in a way that they knew that basically the trend curve was up. They had to change. They had to move in an historically appropriate direction. Do you see that as part of a change mechanism that is now global? Because remember, there are 115 countries we're in tonight.
Yeah. I mean, you know, yes. I mean, you know, also there's really the danger that you know, there could be totalitarian controls placed on the internet, which is, you know, seems to be what's happening in China. You know, it's definitely a little bit of a race against time between the liberational aspects of what's possible and the more, you know, really, really frighteningly totalitarian ones.
By the way, if people want to join this conversation, you can call us on Skype, Enterprise Mission, or The Other Side of Midnight. Our Skype number, 505-796-8802. Dial that on any phone anywhere in the world. That will reach us right here in the Land of Enchantment tonight. This technology, the technology which has allowed us to reach so many people, I think, and I think I agree with you, that that's the reason we're seeing these accelerated changes. But again, it's a right idea. It's a, you know, appropriate idea at the appropriate time that makes for social change. To me, it looks like everything says this is the time for real social change. Do you think the Bernie phenomenon is burning out, or do you think it's just going through a transformation?
I think the Bernie phenomenon was the second coming of the Occupy phenomenon, and the next coming will be the one that works.
Okay. And do you see any outlines of where how that might happen, or do you just want to kind of leave it inchoate?
Well, I don't know exactly, but I think it would just be a continuation of a kind of, you know, mass resonance where you have ordinary people communicating to other people about, you know, what's really going on.
Okay. If you really idolize, and I'm using that term over hyping it deliberately, Bernie, because I think Bernie is very admirable, incredibly admirable, for a whole bunch of reasons. One is his persistence and continuity. I mean, we're not seeing a new guy. This is the same guy who's been there for 30, 40 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which means if he gets into a position of power, what he says is probably what he's going to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Who else in the political spectrum is close to Bernie's political perspectives?
Nobody that we know in ordinary politics. I mean, interesting. I mean, you know, as I said, this is not really like my whole realm, but it'll be interesting to see if they run, you know, Congress people all around the country, you know, who are more in alignment with the millennial perspective.
Well, you know, the other day when he did his internet speech, he asked for people to run locally. 20,000 people responded. And apparently the campaign is offering them money if they'll run locally for, you know, school superintendent, town council, whatever. So that's grassroots democracy. Okay, I guess the question I was going to ask is, what do you think of Elizabeth Warren vis-a-vis Bernie?
I told you, I'm not a pundit.
Oh, so you really aren't familiar with the background of Warren. Okay, well, I am, and if you can't get Bernie...
Richard, I thought we were going to talk about, like, faces on Mars and, you know, scalar technology on the back of the moon. I didn't expect we'd be getting into, like, you know, this very, for me, very redundant kind of, like, stuff around politics.
Well, if we're going through a nodal point of change, I thought we might want to look at those levers where we can affect change, right? And one of them, yes, is in what's really out in the solar system, but that requires an appropriate guy or gal sitting in the White House here in the U.S. who makes decisions for NASA, right?
But, I mean, yeah, or maybe this whole, I mean, you know, maybe it's even going to be a deeper transition, you know, systemically. I mean, you know, three centuries, nobody ever believed the king would be displaced, you know, by bourgeois democracy.
Right.
You know, maybe something is coming that replaces bourgeois democracy, you know, that was something that's very different systemically.
Well, but how do you define bourgeois democracy? Because the founders didn't want a democracy. We don't live in a democracy, Daniel.
Correct.
That's what everybody is freaking out about, because they're discovering, oh my God, this is not a democracy.
Correct.
Do we want one?
I think we have to try it. I mean, you know, the I mean, that's, yeah, I mean, like, look at, you know, Buckminster Fuller wrote that book, Utopia or Oblivion, and he saw that either we were going to, you know, use technical efficiency properly and kind of bring, you know, the world together into one whole, or, you know, we wouldn't make it as a species. And I think, yeah, a global participatory democracy would be part of that, you know, potentially part of that shift. But of course, it brings up a lot of really uncomfortable issues for the developed world, like reparations, you know, for all the minerals and everything that we've extracted, you know, from the rest of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we would have to see, as I said before, we would, you know, it's kind of only imaginable if there was a collective sense of, like, shared sacrifice. And from my perspective, that even requires a shift into, you know, more like mystical, spiritual perspective. And I think, like, one of the great kind of bright spots recently was like the Pope writing that encyclical Care for Our Common Home, where he embraced like a very radical ecological stance, but he put it in alignment with Catholic doctrine.
Hmm. Well, he came out yesterday with a statement. I forget where it was, at a speech or something. I guess it was the reporters on the plane, where he basically apologized to gays for the treatment of the church over the last several hundred years, several thousand years, against gays.
Absolutely. He's doing very extraordinary
things. So does that not say he's a lightning rod for a consciousness shift, that if we empower enough people to say, you can have this, just limit out what you want. It's almost like in the post-Brexit thing, what is it you want? Define what you want. In terms of consciousness, Daniel, what if you could have your best wishes? What would you want to see happen, starting with us domestically here this fall?
Whatever happens with the presidential election, I think there needs to be the development of a grassroots community-based movement, that uses all these social technologies properly. I mean, if you look at something like Facebook, you know, Facebook has all these groups, but you can't do anything with the groups. Like, I have a Facebook group through Evolver. We have like 2 million people on it. You know, if those people could all vote together, you know, they would immediately vote to boycott Monsanto. They would immediately vote to stop using plastic bags, you know, if they felt that their collective voice was something that, you know, had power.
And why can't they be organized that way?
Well, Facebook isn't going to do it because it has nothing to do with their profit motive, which you know, is still tied into.
Wait a minute. Mark Zuckerberg was on a panel at Stanford 3 days ago with the President of the United States talking about international global entrepreneurship. In other words, community on a global scale, moderated and mediated by Facebook, the company he created. You say he does not want you to use your 2 million people to affect positive change?
I think it's very complex. I mean, I actually helped organize a 3-day summit on climate change at Facebook headquarters last May.
Oh.
And we had a bunch of NGOs there, like people from Rainforest Action Network and 350.org. And we had executives from Facebook and WhatsApp and this virtual reality one they just have now. So it was really interesting and instructive. And, you know, I do think that, you know, they're a publicly traded corporation and they have to maximize shareholder value. And therefore they have to support, you know, all sorts of advertisers. And it makes it difficult for them to do things that would go against, you know, what corporate advertising would want. And I think giving people that type of power to make decisions, you know, probably isn't going to happen in Facebook right now. Mm-hmm. It would have to require maybe another social network or social technology to evolve, and maybe it would have to, you know, yeah. So maybe we'll see something evolve in that direction over the next year.
Well, we have these 2 huge international kind of communication systems. One's Facebook, and the other's Twitter. Right? They're the only ones that are left. If they're not going to be the agent, go ahead.
Google also.
And Google. If they're not going to be the mechanism, the vehicle of this social community change message, who is?
Well, we don't know yet. I mean, we have such a funny tendency as human beings. Like, something happens, we're like, oh, like, it's going to be like this forever. But I mean, actually, Facebook and Google are just 10 years old.
Right.
I mean, we've even had these smartphones for about 8 years, you know? So, yeah, so another disruptive social technology could arise that would, you know, empower people in a different way. And a lot of theories and ideas are circulating and kind of experiments are circulating around this. The writer Doug Rushkoff covered some of them in his book, Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus. that was a quite interesting book.
Cute. So what are some of your current projects? Now, we got the book we're going to talk about as you get closer to publishing next year. What are some of the other stuff you're working on?
Well, the main things I'm working on is that book. I wrote a proposal for another book on ayahuasca, which would be looking at maybe its global spread and then also trying to understand, you know, both the positive and the negative aspects of what's happening. I'm also consulting with a group that's has a lot of land in Tulum in Mexico and some land in Berlin, and they want to create kind of like a program around consciousness and actually build communities, which is interesting because they're sort of coming from a high-resourced position to build kind of new model regenerative communities that are like self-sufficient and incorporate the Green School from Bali, the principles of the Green School. So that's pretty exciting, meeting with architects and so on.
Well, that does, because again, see, that's building something. It's hands-on. It's concrete. It's real. People need something real to rally around. So how do we get them to rally around the idea of changing? I mean, how would you change the founding documents to make this a more applicable, equitable, direct democracy without the fear of mob rule, which the founders were all kind of terrified about?
Well, I don't really have that fear of mob rule. I think we should see what happens if we give people, you know, the opportunity.
But we are. It's called Donald Trump. I actually think, Daniel, I know you hate politics, but I think we're going to wind up electing him. It's almost like we deserve him. You know why? Because so many of us have not taken our responsibility for actually representative government seriously from the beginning. It's like, oh, that's somebody else. I'll just live in the land, but let somebody else do the work. We may wind up ruining the day that all those people elected Donald Trump president, because then the question is, can the Republic survive a Donald Trump presidency?
Yeah, well, as I said, if that happens, you know, potentially it's necessary, you know, just like, I mean, I'm really wish we could change the subject.
Okay,
but,
all right.
You know, Brexit, you know, or Trump, you know, maybe the necessary, you know, kind of breaking points.
Well, to me, if we're talking social change, we're looking at social change right in the face, Daniel. We can't ignore it. We can't hide under the bed. It's happening all around us. I'm trying to figure out why it's happening and how we can maybe steer it in more positive directions.
Right.
That's why ideas are good. All right, let's talk a bit more about this book, because it seems to me the book should be published now, not in several months, because the ideas expressed in the book are relevant to now.
Yeah, well, I mean, they'll hopefully be relevant, you know, 6 months from now also.
Unless we've moved. See, the future is
The idea in the book is to look at the transition that we need to make, and sort of the three kind of wheels, I guess, that we see turning, you know, the situation is, one is the kind of technical infrastructure, which includes like agriculture, industry, energy. Then there's the social system, the political economic system. And then finally, there's the culture, ideology, mythology, belief system, the values that you know, lie beneath that. And somehow all of these three wheels kind of work together. You know, so we can see kind of the paradigm that we have now in terms of how we're doing agriculture, how we're producing energy, and where we need to get to, you know, in a few decades.
Have you looked into, for urban areas, these urban agriculturists who are basically talking about transforming entire buildings to make three-dimensional, almost skyscraper agri-farms in the middle of urban environments?
Yeah, of course. Vertical farming is super interesting. I'm also really interested in this thing that's coming out of Stanford now called Regen Villages.
I haven't heard about those. Tell me about those.
I think they're just doing the first one in Holland, or maybe it's Denmark. But essentially, the idea is to create modular villages that are entirely self-sufficient, where they produce energy, they produce food, they compost, you know, et cetera. And if you could create a model for that, they could be great for the refugee communities. There's no doubt as climate change accelerates and sea levels rise and fresh water runs out, we're going to have a lot of environmental refugees around the world. We're going to need some very innovative ways to resettle them.
Well, the whole refugee situation in Europe is kind of like only a presaging of things to come if the planet really goes cattywampus climatologically.
Did you say cattywampus?
Cattywampus, yes.
I like that.
It's an old term from my grandmother, and it describes exactly what I'm saying. Cattywampus, yes. The planet is now cattywampus. How do we get it back in line? Will the revolutions that you and I are thinking about, will they happen fast enough? Up until Brexit, I would have said no. But seeing the political bomb that Brexit has created, where all kind of, there's nothing in place to replace. It's like if you move in with the right kind of plan that attracts the right kind of, you know, connection, people will follow you because they're looking for answers. And the guys in charge apparently have no answers on this one.
Somebody's asked, your friend Em has asked, the real question is, how can Burning Man save us? Which is a very funny question.
Oh, speaking of Burning Man, since Robin is such a fan of Burning Man, how did Burning Man start? And I want you to describe a bit about Burning Man, because
Yeah, we only have about 5 minutes left, and I'm getting super tired. It's almost 5 a.m. here.
Okay.
But very quickly, Burning Man, I think it started in like the 80s or early 90s. This guy, Larry Harvey, burned a small statue of a man on Baker Beach. More and more people started to get into it. It was picked up by a kind of radical art group there. They moved it to the Black Rock Desert, and it's expanded rapidly. When I went, it was like 35,000 people 15 years ago. Now it's about 80,000 people. It's attracting more and more of the international jet set, the wealthy people from all around Europe and Ibiza and so on.
So is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I mean, it's I think ultimately it's a good thing. The festival is a very extraordinary expression of human creativity.
And what goes on at Burning Man?
Well, whatever you want. It's an expression of human freedom. Some people do workshops. Some people dance all night. Some people make art. Some people pray. Some people meditate. Some people talk to each other. And then it has principles which have been kind of codified. There's 10 principles that include gifting, leave no trace. And for me, the most interesting thing about Burning Man anthropologically is how just having those different principles changes immediately, how people relate with each other, how they live. And it really suggests that human nature is very malleable, and that with a new set of rules and principles that were better than the old rules.
So, wait, this is fascinating. This is really so. You're saying Burning Man is kind of like an ongoing simulation, cultural and civilization simulation of people operating under different rules, but with the same technologies, but interacting with each other really differently than we do in the so-called real world.
Yeah, exactly. I think that in the real world, we've underestimated the importance of what you could call like social technologies, which includes like rules that people share.
You mean like people being nice to each other?
People being nice to each other, people being accepting of each other, people focusing on the gift, all these beautiful things.
When you say gift, is this kind of like the Native American potlatch ceremony?
This idea that pre-monetary systems, the main form of exchange was gift-based. Lewis Hyde wrote a beautiful book called The Gift, where he looks at how the gift moves towards the empty place. It was just a natural way of indigenous economic systems that would distribute resources and make sure that everybody had something.
Well, again, if Burning Man is kind of like these running simulations where we see what works, what's the mechanism of taking those little experiments and exporting them to the real world so we can actually all participate in the experiment?
Yeah, that's a really beautiful question. And I guess that's one of the ideas that I'm putting forth in the book, is if we could experiment with changing like the social rules, the financial rules, rather than that would be part of our, a shift from unconscious evolution to conscious evolution.
Do you know Elon Musk?
I don't know him personally, but I'm very impressed with a lot of what he's doing.
Likewise. Seems to me Elon Musk is someone you ought to talk to about this, because if he's funding like the Hyperloop and the Tesla vehicle and the SpaceX reusable rockets and all that, giving us access that we need to verify all that's really out there, Daniel, seems to me, since he was mentioning Burning Man in a very positive light a few months ago and part of some kind of a corporate village they're designing or something during the festivals, that he might be one to talk to about socializing some of these experiments on a larger scale.
I think there's a long line of people trying to speak to Elon Musk right now. so I don't know if I want to get on that line, but maybe he'll listen to the show.
I'll tell you what, we're trying to get him on the show. I'll make you a deal. If I get him on the show, I'll get you on the show, and you can talk to him, you can ask him anything you want about Burning Man, how to make it bigger and extrapolate the good experiments to the culture we live in. Deal?
Sure, man. I would love to chat with him any opportunity.
Okay. Okay, we only got a couple of minutes left. What are you doing next? Tomorrow morning, what are you doing next?
What am I doing tomorrow morning?
Tomorrow morning.
I don't know. I'm having a beautiful little vacation at the moment, because I'm waiting for, the books in the process of turning into galleys, and waiting to hear about my next book proposal. So I'm actually just going to enjoy New York in summer for a few days.
Summer in New York. Yeah. There is nothing like summer in New York. I'll tell you what, did you ever work with a guy named Russell Brand?
Yeah, well, I mean, Russell reached out to me after he saw my documentary, 2012 Time for Change. He visited me in Utah at an event I was doing.
Because he was one of these social inventors. He had this incredible magazine based out of San Francisco.
Well, you said Russell Brands?
Yeah, Russell Brands.
I don't think he had a magazine out of San Francisco. He's the comedian.
No, I'm thinking, maybe I'm talking about another Russell. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No, I was talking about another Russell. All right, what about Russell Brand, the comedian?
Well, I was just saying that I had a lot of interaction with him, and he wrote about me in his last book, Revolution. My ideas definitely influenced him in terms of like alternative possibilities. And he did great. He created a video channel called The Trues. He really raised consciousness particularly in England for a while, but now he's kind of on a vacation himself.
Ah, yeah. If you go to Radio with Pictures, you'll see a picture of you guys at the bottom there. There's a video, which I think everybody should take a look at, Mind Shift, Enlightening Our Global Culture. That's with Russell. And then at the top, there's a cover shot from Rolling Stone with Bob Dylan. What's your involvement with that?
Rolling Stone wrote a kind of negative profile of me.
Oh, no. By Vanessa, what's her name? Gregoria Diaz.
Yeah.
Why was it negative? And you don't have time to answer because there's our music. Hey, Daniel, you got to come back on. Thank you so much. This has been an interesting moment. There'll be more. My guest this morning, Daniel Pinchbeck. So until tomorrow morning, which is Open Hailing Frequencies, where we're going to grapple with what's going on and invite all of your participations from all 115 countries on this planet. Remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.